This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Today, a special presentation from Florida Public Radio and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Trade in agricultural products, water quality, and concealed weapons permits. Those are just some of the issues in the race to be Florida's next agriculture commissioner. The three Democratic candidates competing for their party's nomination to be Commissioner of Agriculture are Fort Lauderdale lobbyist Nikki Freed, South Florida Audubon Society President Roy David Walker, and Homestead Mayor Jeff Porter. The three candidates in the Democratic primary sat down with WLRN's Tom Hudson and the editorial page editors of the South Florida Sun Sentinel, the Miami Herald, and the Palm Beach Post to explain why they're running.
Jeffrey Porter, Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Tired of seeing agriculture die in South Florida. Born in Homestead, mayor of Homestead. It's Miami-Dade County is the second largest producer of ag products in the state behind Palm Beach. Over the years that I've been, involved, agriculture has really been under pressure and is literally dying in South Florida. And with being involved in politics, being elected for 15 years, I felt like it was the time to move into something else where I could help the community in a larger scale. And it's almost criminal what I've seen happen to ag. So and obviously the consumer services aspect of it as well. We've got a lot of older population that just get taken advantage of. And being number one in fraud is really, not something we should wear proudly. And I felt like it was an opportunity for me to do have a larger reach.
I'm Roy David Walker, scientist, running for Commissioner of Agriculture. I decided to run for Commissioner of Agriculture because as an environmental biologist working for the state of Florida and U.S. government, politics got in the way of my research. When I was working with the state of Florida, I was working with Florida Fish and Wildlife as well as volunteering with the Environmental Department Agency. And as I traveled the state and talked about different issues, I wasn't allowed to use the word climate change. And that's when I decided to become more active in politics and to make awareness of our agriculture industry when it comes to conservation, when it comes to our water, which is our livelihood. And right now we're seeing the effects of runoff and special interests around Okeechobee and the Orlando area as well. So I'm looking to use my science background to grow the agriculture industry, to protect our environment, and to conserve our environment, especially our water, just as important to protect our consumers. Yeah, we are number one in fraud and number two at identity theft. And that's from the gas pump. That's from the do not call list. And these are systems that fall underneath the Commissioner of Agriculture. And nothing has been done over the years.
My name is Nikki Freed. I'm running for Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services. I'm running for this position because I have seen how Tallahassee is broken. And with my leadership skills and my knowledge of how the state works and things that I've been working for, saw this as an opportunity to go up to Tallahassee, make a difference, bring agriculture into new light, into new face, into new technology, and going towards more expansion of medical marijuana as far as also industrial hemp. And saw it as a great combination of all the things I've ever cared about in my entire life on the consumer services component, as well as agriculture, and putting my leadership skills to good use and hopefully making a change in Tallahassee.
Howard Goodman, editorial writer of the Palm Beach Post. What role would the agriculture commissioner play in medical marijuana and in implementing medical marijuana?
First off, already inside the Department of Agriculture, it oversees the pesticides, which is every single one of the growers has to deal with pesticides. It will oversee our food and safety qualities. As soon as the department puts out rules dealing with the edibles, it will oversee that process. It also has over $20 million worth of federal resources to go after illegal producers of medical marijuana in the state. I would probably imagine that our current commissioner doesn't even know that that exists. And then, also more importantly, you're a member of the cabinet, which has an earshot to the governor. And I know I've spoken to every one of the governor candidates in the Democratic side talking about medical marijuana and what has happened in the process. And so I know that all of them will be looking to me for leadership as far as choosing new directors of the Office of Medical Marijuana Use and the policies, that there's no one in the state that knows kind of the inner workings of the current department, the regulations, and somebody like me. And so they are going to look to my leadership and my knowledge of the industry. And then, as we all know, We are seeing a huge uptick across the country and interest here in the state as we go into potential legalization. And so once we go into a legalization format, then it is just an agricultural crop. And there's going to be a movement to actually take Department of Medical Marijuana Use and move it into the Department of Agriculture, which means that the commissioner will have an opportunity to not only help develop the future legalization program, but the implementation of it. And you also have to deal with the industrial hemp aspect of it as well, which is also underneath the Department of Agriculture already.
For clarification, when you talk about legalization, do you mean recreational use?
It's adult use is what the
terminology. So recreational use by 18 years old or older?
Well, it's typically when we see legalization, we talk about adult use, which is typically 21 and up. And so it would be a legalization, but I have been a huge proponent that we keep the two programs separate. You have medical still being a robust program, as well as potential legalization and adult use. That way that the product, if it gets taxed, only taxes the legalization aspect of it and not the medical side for all the patients. And
so do you support that legalization for recreational use for 21 years old and older?
I have said that I would, yes, and that it's something that can create $20 to $30 billion of tax revenue to the state of Florida. That is to help with our education, our infrastructure, for affordable housing projects. And if we keep also a very robust medical program, not only are we not taxing those products, but we're also, which I've been a huge advocate of, is making sure that our healthcare providers are starting to cover this as part of the co-pays in their annuals. So that decreases individuals who are on opiates and other pharmaceutical drugs, and also will decrease the overall cost of healthcare.
Hi, I'm Rosemary O'Hara, the editorial page editor of the South Florida Sun Sentinel. You said that recreational marijuana for adults could create $20 to $30 billion in tax revenue for Florida. State budget is $86 billion. So you're saying we could have $30 billion a year
in
just in recreational marijuana?
Recreational and hemp. As a combination of the two, yes.
I'm Nancy Ankrum. I am the editorial page editor of the Miami Herald. Mr. Walker, would you address medical marijuana and marijuana and versus recreational?
I'm 100% for medical marijuana as well as adult use and as well as hemp. Now, currently it does fall underneath the Department of Health, and currently the standards that are currently in place, well, there aren't any. And that's unfortunate because people are relying on this for as medicine. And as a medicine, I believe that aspect should have a good relationship with the agriculture department. Now, speaking of hemp, I'm a big believer in hemp because I like to use the example of our citrus industry. Now, the citrus industry has declined dramatically under 7.5 years underneath the current administration. But with citrus greening and the last hurricane, the citrus greening has really hurt the industry. And the fact that has been proven that the citrus greening is now in our soil, and one way to actually clean the soil is working planted alongside hemp. We clean the soil, and in fact, if you remove the tree, put a new tree in, it's been proven that it may not come back from different studies around Europe. I'm fully favor on taxing the adult use aspect, but until that becomes legal, it does not fall underneath agriculture. Currently, it's underneath the Department of Health.
Okay. Mr. Porter?
Well, it's the legislature's responsibility to deal with the voter-approved medical marijuana process that's been, you know, that's what the voter asked for. They've been dragging their feet and administering administering medical marijuana out correctly. You know, in our city, we've had to deal with the regulatory aspect because the state oversees the growing aspect of the medical marijuana. It's very, very tightly done, and it's not like, you know, the common thought would be you got a 5-acre field, you go out and you plant 5 acres of marijuana and you harvest it. And no, it's under very, very tight triple security cameras, much like you would see in a lab. So that's all driven by the state, not by the ag department. You know, I as far as it goes with recreational, you know, I oversee a police department, and you know that we've got to deal with some things first with the medical marijuana aspect of it before we start talking about dealing with recreational use. In my opinion. The issue of hemp has been brought up. We've talked about it, you know, with our ag groups in the south, south end of the state here. And, you know, there are so many benefits. Not only, I mean, it's in the construction field. It's used in construction. It's used in farm animal feed. It's got so many opportunities for markets that that could use the product. And as we look at our ag industry having to retool itself to basically, you know, as the temperature warms, you know, we call it however we're getting here, but it's warmer than it used to be. And so our seasons to be able to get ahead of the rest of the country are shortened. We don't, you know, now they're growing oranges in Georgia. You know, so the warming of the planet is affecting our ability to grow the certain crops that we are accustomed to growing. So,
Just for clarification, do you support the legalization of marijuana for recreational use among adults?
At this point, no.
Starting with Mr. Walker. Can you talk about what needs to be done to protect Florida's agricultural culture here?
Finding the right direction for the citrus is very, very important. Now, the ways to grow that would be, of course, for those who are currently own that the acreage, the groves that are currently abandoned. Now, we need programs at a state level to convert those and work with those landowners so they can still remain on that land and still own an income, whether it be switching to a new source of revenue, which could be possibly hemp, or even renewable energy programs, for that example, because renewable energy does fall underneath the employment of agriculture. So speaking of that, that could be silver. It could be hemp. It could be blueberries. Blueberries is something that's coming up over right now in our state of Florida. And it's really good. It will actually bring in a few billion dollars as well.
Well, the University of Florida at IFAS has spent about $100 million so far on doing type of research on the greening effects and how and different cures. And so I know that the citrus industry has, over the last few years, tried using some of these different types of procedures that they've learned from IFAS. And so what we thought was going to happen this year was going to be a growth in the citrus industry. And unfortunately, the hurricane came in and destroyed what they thought was going to be prosperous here. And so what we need to be doing is also encouraging not only to citrus, because citrus is one component of our agriculture community. We have local farmers all across the state who are suffering just as much, if not equally. And what's happened in the last 8 years is that there hasn't been as much support throughout the state to go and try to get some national dollars and bring it back. There's also a trust fund inside the Department of Agriculture for Innovation. And that is also not broadcasted, that there's an opportunity for different local growers to go after some of this innovation fund, come up with new ideas, new ways to deal with soil, new ways to deal with other mosquitoes and infrastructure and new technologies, and give them the resources to become innovative and to become look forward to different types of aspects. And also, we have to go up to D.C. And the reality is that the trade wars and tariffs and NAFTA is hurting our agriculture community. And without the proper leadership that currently our current leadership is supporting everything that's happening in D.C. And as somebody who would be representing the entire industry, I'd be going up to D.C. fighting all of these issues, bringing to light of how much it is hurting our state of Florida.
Mr. Porter.
Well, you know, obviously, you know, from the farmer's aspect, if they can't make a living, you know, their asset is their land. And so I think we've got to really work out a way where, and especially like I was talking earlier about the weather pattern has changed, where we used to have cold weather and that would give us a chance to get our products to the market first at a higher value. Since we don't have that cold weather advantage any longer, it's harder for us to compete. And I think that's in citrus. I think that's in all of our ag products across the state. So, you know, I think we need to look at it. If ag is truly as important to the state as everybody says it is, we need to really take a good hard look at carving out a way to make it survive. And maybe it's not allowing Mexico to import for 30 days or 60 days. Well, we can get our tomatoes out first, or, you know, give our farmers, you know, a competitive advantage through legislation statewide.
It sounds like you all have different positions on the tariffs and the trade war, that in your impression that NAFTA was bad for agriculture in Florida. Is that an accurate assessment of what I'm hearing here?
Let me just say this. NAFTA, portions of NAFTA have been beneficial. Mexico has not honored the spirit of NAFTA, and we have not enforced the no dumping aspect of NAFTA. We do export more than we used to through NAFTA, but the unfortunate side effect of what NAFTA did is it has put too much pressure. It's killed the tomato industry in South Florida. We're down to probably 3,000 acres from what was 30,000, and that three will be gone probably in 2 years.
I think it boils down to that our agriculture in the state of Florida, it's a national security issue. That is, if our agriculture department and our agriculture in the state of Florida, it's not, again, just citrus. It is not just our vegetables and our produce. It's also our dairy. It's also our cattle. And if we are not able to have a robust agriculture community here in the state of Florida, and that we are not as, that we are becoming reliant on other countries bringing in our food products, and that becomes national security, that we are having to rely on other countries for some of our produce if we are not able to have our local farmers here in the state of Florida grow. I agree with Mayor Porter that NAFTA does need to be renegotiated, especially when it comes to the seasonal produce.
Mr. Walker.
At the end of the day, we need to protect our agriculture industry. It's a $120 billion industry, and right now people are closing their gates. They're selling to the highest bidder for development, for shopping centers and parking lots.
You would be a member of the governor's cabinet. You would also make up the clemency board. Though Amendment 4 might make this issue moot for you, but can you tell us your stance on the restoration of felons' rights, Mr. Porter?
I certainly agree with rights restorations, because I mean, obviously, anybody can make a mistake, and if you pay your debt, you should be given your rights back, and
automatically.
I mean, there's no if you've sentenced to a year, it's not a sentence for life, you know. So I think that certainly, I hope Amendment 4 passes, but as a clemency board member. Yeah, I would say you definitely want to give people their rights back and get them back into society as quick as possible.
I have the Amendment 4. Now, I really do hope it passes. I truly believe that when someone served their times and then they are released, they should have the rights reinstated right then.
As a past public defender, I saw firsthand the injustice again in the criminal justice system, and I have been talking about restoration of rights for years, and the fact that the Supreme Court has said that our process is unconstitutional, and yet our cabinet continuously is following appeals and going through the process, and the fact that CFO Petronas had questioned some of the individuals in front of them a couple weeks ago and started asking them questions that have absolutely nothing to do with their restoration of rights. It's deplorable that these are elected officials asking these types of questions. We spend over $400 million a year not restoring these individuals' rights. If you've served your time, then you automatically should be restored your rights. And the fact that if a criminal justice system has said you have served your time, you have been rehabilitated, then that is it's the will of the justice system.
What do you see your role as being, assuming you become Act Commissioner, in Florida's water issues?
I think that we're instrumental. I have three R's. First is regionalization, is the fact that our departments are not talking to each other. Your DEP, your Department of Agriculture, your water management districts, your local governments are not communicating, and that we need to start there. We need to start saying, you know, what are the best management programs, and things are different between the coastal communities and the central part of our state. We have different water flows, different areas that need different amounts, and stop these regional wars that are between as far as who can use the water. Then we start going towards the actual system in place. You know, we know that, you know, the next 20 years, our population is going to grow by at least 6 million people. And as we continue to have that, we're going to have to continue to draw out our water sources. And so we need to make sure that the infrastructure is also, you know, up to speed. So a lot of our pipes have not been restored in decades. They're rotting away, can't actually uphold some of the flow of the waters, and are actually leaking chemicals into our water system. So we need to make sure that there is potentially, like they do on transportation projects, a fund that is put into place where local governments can take the money out as a loan and then put the money back in once the water projects are done. And the third is also reusable. I mean, the fact of the matter is that we only have a limited amount of water supply in the state of Florida. And as our population grows and as our agriculture department and community hopefully continues to grow, that we need to be able to come up with new ideas for recyclable water.
As commissioner, your job is to make sure that different industries is using the best management practices, which is voluntary, not mandatory, to make sure they're not polluting our waterway. But they need to be held accountable when they do pollute.
Everyone knows this. We have a wet season, we have a dry season. We have a storage problem as much as we have anything else, because we store the water in the lake to a point where we have to dump it. You've got to go back to the beginning of the lake and create storage areas, wetland areas, like it used to be. Let that sheet flow of water slowly run into the lake. It'll be cleaner when it gets to the lake, and you do the same thing on the outflow.
On the consumer issue, why is the do not call list so difficult to enforce? And why do we still have people scamming, reading our credit cards at gas stations? Mr. Walker.
Yes, the do not call list. And well, it's a program that's regulating the consumers, not the corporations. Now, I believe that this program should be reversed and put the corporations on the list so that the department can hold them accountable. And by doing that, that means they will have to come to Florida and open up an office so that they can be held accountable. So that when it comes to the do not call list. Now, fraud, of course, has been number one within the current administration. And they do get this information mainly at the gas pumps. Now, technology has advanced over the years. It used to be when you insert your credit card, it was there at the reader. So you used to always jiggle before inserting your credit card to make sure there's no attachment. However, technology has advanced, and actually they're now putting devices inside the gas pumps so that they transfer the data remotely. Now, to fix that problem, one way to solve that is inserting the chip on your credit card. They do that in Europe and other places. When you insert that chip, that means your card has to be there, and then they won't collect that data. Now, also with the device inside the machine, now one way to do that is to make sure that the pump is actually secure. And that can be as simple as putting a security label on the side of that pump, a seal, so that the consumers can know if it's been opened, it would be cracked.
Mr. Porter?
Well, I think the technology is lacking. You know, there are security efforts there are security aspects that are being incorporated that are protecting the credit cards better than they are at the gas pump. They're still using the swipe process. The do not call. They're just not enforcing. I don't know what to do. I really don't know what to do.
It's about enforcement. This is bigger than just, you know, mechanics and technology. You know, down in South Florida, there is actually a cartel that is running the scams. And so a lot of this comes into the consumers. There is an entire legal department, an investigation department inside of the Consumer Services Agency. And that's just not been used to come down and work with law enforcement and trying to break up the cartel ring that has been controlling South Florida on the fraud of the gas station pumps. So you start going after criminal activity and start kind of breaking that down at the gas station pumps. And the same thing with the do not call list. It's called enforcement. It's called, getting in there and actually prosecuting and sending those individuals who are violating this over to the Attorney General for prosecution purposes. So this is a leadership issue, and that has just not been addressed and being proactive to fix this. It is not a simple fix, but it is something that needs to be a robust program in order to take these individuals down who are committing this fraud against the consumers.
And that was Nikki Freed, Roy David Walker, and Jeff Porter, the three candidates in the Democratic primary for Florida Agriculture Commissioner. They spoke to WLRN's Tom Hudson and the editorial page editors of the Miami Herald, the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and the Palm Beach Post. And that conversation was produced by WLRN Public Media in Miami and Florida Public Radio. Still to come on Intersection, there's water on the moon.
We've had a lot of previous detections that indicated that there probably was water on the moon, but this is the first sort of direct detection.
So what does that mean for space exploration and exploitation of lunar resources? We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. NASA has confirmed there's water on the moon. A team of scientists analyzed data from NASA's Moon Mineralogy Mapper, which rode on board the Chandrayaan spacecraft launched in 2008, and they found definitive signs of water on the moon's polar regions, the darkest, coldest places on the moon. For more, we're joined by Dr. Addie Dove. She's a planetary scientist and assistant professor of physics at the University of Central Florida. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So it's been confirmed that there is water on the moon. This is quite exciting. Tell me about the discovery and what this means.
Yeah, it's exciting. They found for the first time water on the surface of the moon. We've had a lot of previous detections that indicated that there probably was water on the moon, but this is the first sort of direct detection. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of interest in it right now. So scientifically, it's very interesting because how does it get there? How does it stay on the surface? Those are all really interesting scientific questions. But a lot of the reason it's getting traction right now is because of the interest in what's called ISRU. So that's called its in-situ resource utilization. Hmm. So it's the idea that we can go to other planetary surfaces and use the resources that are there to make a living or to make fuel or water and things like that that humans can drink when they're off planet.
Right. And I guess one way to look at it is the moon could be essentially like a gas station in space for missions that want to go further.
Yeah, so there's a lot of interest in sort of forming a long-term colony on the moon. So if we do that, we need resources there that we don't always have to take with us, because one of the hardest things is getting things off the surface of the Earth. But also as a gas station, if you're going on to further in the solar system to Mars or to different asteroids and things like that. Mm-hmm. One caveat, right, is that there's not a lot of water in this detection. It's that there's little bits of water in certain specific areas at the poles. So these are areas at the poles that are always, they're called permanently shadowed regions. They're always in shadow right now. And so they're really, really cold. They're like 25 Kelvin, which for reference is one of the coldest places in the solar system. 25 degrees above absolute zero.
All right. So are these essentially like ice caps, kind of like the ice caps we have on Earth, or is it a bit different from that?
It's a bit different. So it's very small amounts of ice that are probably mixed in with the rock down in the bottom of these really dark craters. Mm-hmm. So there's some small percentage of ice that's there on the surface, but it's mixed in and probably adsorbed onto the rocks or mixed in with them.
How do they find it? How do they confirm that there is ice?
The data is actually from a mission that flew back in 2009 called Chandrayaan, and it was an Indian mission. But there was an instrument on board called the Moon Mineralogy Mapper, M-cubed, that was built here in the U.S. And we've looked at this, and this mission was actually one of the first to sort of, in more recent years, to detect that there might be water on the surface. But they really combed through the data and looked at specific reflectance spectra in this case. So they looked at the light that's being sort of bounced back from the surface of the moon. Mm-hmm. And they saw that there's signatures of water molecules.
So this spacecraft, it's just been orbiting the moon since 2008?
So unfortunately, it had a pretty short lifespan. It ended its mission about 14 months early, I think, because there were a lot of issues with thermal heating of the spacecraft. And so the spacecraft stopped responding back in 2009, and I think it might have crashed into the surface. But we haven't communicated with it since 2009.
So essentially, you still had all this data collected from it, and it was just a matter of sifting through it and figuring out what it meant.
Yeah, so some of the early data indicated that there was water on the surface, but it was actually detecting what's called hydroxyl, so OH molecules that could either be a signature of water or something else mixed in with the rocks. But some researchers did a really detailed statistical analysis this time and really combed through the data to pull out these signatures. And one of the tricky things is that the data is really what we call noisy. So you're looking for a signal in something, but it's really hard to see that above the background noise. So it's like, mm-hmm. if you're trying to hear somebody in a room, but everybody else is loud too, right? It's hard to hear that one person. Mm-hmm. So looking for this signal in that room of all the loud people is really hard. So they had to statistically look and see if they could pull out these signals.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Dr. Addy Dove, planetary scientist and assistant physics professor at UCF, about the confirmation of ice on the moon. So it's not just people who are interested in exploration and what it means for getting humans out into space and establishing a colony there, right? There's also some commercial interests at play. What does water on the moon mean for folks who have an interest in getting something out of the moon?
For sure, yeah. So one of the new areas of interest is mining asteroids or potentially the moon's surface. And the commercial interest in this is sort of, as you mentioned earlier, kind of like a gas station on your way out to other places in the solar system. So if we ever want to do exploration beyond Earth orbit, we need resources. And one of the closest places to get those is the moon. So if you can find reliable ways to extract resources, then you can have longer term exploration and also profit, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons ice or water is so interesting is because it can be used as fuel. So you can break down the molecules and you have hydrogen and oxygen that can be used as fuel, and also just as a resource for water, for cooling systems, for drinking, things like that.
Mm-hmm. How do you use that water? Like, what's the next step? How would you extract it and how would you turn it into something useful?
So you have to do different mining techniques, basically. You have to learn how to separate the water from the rock. A lot of times that's done by either heating it up. So you can use sort of microwaves. You can use just thermal heat to heat up the water and separate it out from the rock. And then you would use it in sort of a processing facility like we do in a lot of different types of mining operations here on Earth.
Mm-hmm. And there's research being done on the kinds of vehicles you would need to actually get this stuff out and use it?
Yeah, there are lots of interesting designs for things like drills where you drill down into the surface to pull out the water and the rock. Some people have sort of scoops for more surface level things. There's a really cool competition that takes place each year at Kennedy Space Center called the Robotic Mining Competition, and that's where students from teams all across the country at universities all across the country build different rovers that would be able to scoop up these kinds of things, and so they compete for cool designs to do things like that as well. But there's also a lot of commercial interest, so like Caterpillar sponsors that competition.
How involved is UCF in designing some of the hardware, or students there, and figuring out some of the ways to use some of these resources?
So in the planetary science group, we have a lot of interest in ISRU, in in-situ resource utilization, and ways that we can detect it on other surfaces and then also figure out ways to use it. And so we partner with some companies around the country on that.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a group, the Lunar Knights, who participate in the RMC, the mining competition, every year. And there are some other groups around campus who are sort of interested in what these resources could do and how you can utilize them.
Mm-hmm. What's the next step then? It's one thing to send up, you know, an orbiting spacecraft, have it bring back a bunch of data, but then I guess the next thing might be to actually go and see if you can get your hands on some of this ice.
Yeah, that would be great. People have been proposing lunar sample return missions for a long time. One of the big challenges is that all of this ice is at the poles, the polar regions, and all of our other missions so far have mostly gone to sort of the equatorial regions because they're easier to get to. There's more challenges with going to the poles. But a lot of the proposed planetary science missions from around the world have looked at going to polar regions because of these resources that might be there in the permanently shadowed regions, and also because there's areas at the poles that are constantly in light. So it's the complete opposite end of the spectrum where they're always in light, so you'd have a lot of energy there.
Mm-hmm. So what's next? What's the next step for scientists who are looking into this?
So there's still a lot of data in other data sets. So some of the earlier signatures of water on the moon that have shown that maybe there's some transient water on the surface sometimes throughout the day have come from other orbiters. There's the LRO, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, is still orbiting the moon, and they're sending back data in the UV and in neutrons that give us these signatures as well, so combing through that data. But like you mentioned, I think sample return or sending something, even if we don't return it, sending something there to drill and to actually see what's there on the surface would be awesome. We've sent all these different missions to sort of scrape the surface on Mars, right, at the poles. We can do a similar thing at the moon and really learn what's going on down there.
Dr. Addy Dove, planetary scientist and assistant professor of physics at UCF, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come on Intersection, a new African-American ecumenical hymnal includes hymns by Central Florida musicians Carl Maltsby and Gail Jones Murphy. Both Maltsby and Jones Murphy grew up surrounded by church music, and their families recognized their talent for music early. A conversation about sacred and secular music when Intersection returns.
We are not consumed.
His mercies are new every day. His compassion my soul is due. His mercies are new every day.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty.
Sit down, servant, rest a little while. Sit down.
That's a hymn called Sit Down Servant by Carl Maltby. It's part of a collection of African-American ecumenical hymns that's just been published, One Lord, One Faith, One Baptism. I spoke to Maltby and composer Gail Jones Murphy about the hymnal. Maltby began the conversation.
Most people think of gospel.
Right.
They don't even think spirituals.
That's true.
And what I like about this particular collection, One Lord, One Faith, One Baptism, is that we had as part of our mission to preserve that historical element, which is why we went back to some of the other publications. And then, and like on our second meeting, we were given the instruction, bring to the table those chestnuts from your worship tradition that you could not live without in a hymnal. So we were very much aware of that whole historical collection. Let me read you a quote here, which I think is very important. And this came from the Reverend Charles G. Adams, who is the senior pastor of Hartford Memorial Baptist Church in Detroit. He said, "I want it all. The wisdom of Lincoln and the compassion of Roosevelt, the heritage of Washington and the legacy of King, the social ministries of the Methodists and the strict theology of the Presbyterians, the pioneering protests of the Lutherans and the defiant spirit of Richard Allen, the kingdom keys of St. Peter and the glorious liberty of the nonconformists, the gorgeous liturgy of the Episcopalians and the intellectual honesty of the Unitarians, the spiritual fervor of the Pentecostals and the marvelous freedom the folks call Baptists. I want it all because there's no place for narrowness and bigotry in the Church of Jesus Christ. We're all in one and we are one in all." And that was the guiding spirit of this collection.
Yeah. Gail Jones Murphy, tell me about how you got involved in composing hymns. Like, what's your musical background?
Wow. Okay. So I'm one of those people who I think was prayed into existence. I had a father who looked up in the sky one night when he was 10 years old and asked God for a little girl who could play piano. And ta-da, I was born. I began playing piano at age 3, picking out one finger on the little toy piano they had given me, playing Yes, Jesus Loves Me, which is a published hymn. And because I grew up in church music, I learned old hymns, What a Friend We Have in Jesus, Blessed Assurance. By the time I was age 5, I was given the task of being one of the designated pianists at my church.
At age 5?
At age 5. By the time I was 16, I was the music director.
Wow.
I need to write a book on how to direct a music program when everybody's older than you. But that's another book.
What was that like for you? Was it easy to lead that group of musicians?
You know what? I knew that I had been gifted with music, but I also had very wise parents who gave me structure and discipline and taught me how to be respectful of my elder. So I did it with wisdom and with kindness and with as much joy and enthusiasm as any youthful person would do. I'm still youthful at 29 and holding. However, I also learned a lot about myself as a leader, and I learned a lot about leading God's people. I enjoy working for God, but some of his people I have to pray for. But moving on, I've been a musician all my life. I started writing, my first composition was age 5, wrote a little piano piece, but I actually seriously started writing music as a teenager in college, and then started recording some of it as a vocal artist and as a pianist. So it just became apparent to me that I was really gifted in the area of making words and melody come together that other people enjoyed singing. Mm-hmm. And so I really wanted to make a difference with the music that I have. So I've got about 700 compositions at this point.
And what was the church that you grew up in and became the music director of?
And I still am. I'm Seventh-day Adventist. Mm-hmm. And as he talks about how the Episcopalians were underrepresented in hymn books, I don't think you can count a lot of Seventh-day Adventist hymns in outside publications outside of maybe just their own. So I'm excited that I get to be listed.
Carl Maltzby, do you have some standouts in here, like either your own or others that you really think people should pay attention to?
Oh, yes. Yeah. One I'd like to point out, because I just learned on the way here that Aretha Franklin passed. I had the pleasure of meeting Aretha in the 70s, actually at Ashford and Simpson's home. And she was just a warm, congenial spirit. But my first entry in One Lord, One Faith Baptism is Sit Down, Servant. And I'd like to dedicate that to the memory of Aretha Franklin. Mm-hmm. Ironically enough, one of Aretha's gospel albums for Atlantic Records is entitled One Lord, One Faith, One Baptism. Mm.
Tell me more about your meeting with Aretha Franklin.
Oh, it was very, very, very casual gathering. She was very, very warm, very shy, but we just had this light chit chat, party conversation, and the like. Because I had more interaction with her sister Carolyn, because I worked at RCA Records where Carolyn Franklin was signed, and her brother Cecil Franklin. I interacted with them more, but my interaction with Aretha was just that one opportunity. But she was a great influence on me because of that gospel piano playing of hers.
Oh yeah.
That when I was in college at Lake Forest College in Lake Forest, Illinois, I had a group called the Soul Syndicate, and of course, you know, our big performance requested tune was Respect. with that Aretha Franklin. In fact, we did a lot of her songs at that particular time.
What did you play?
Oh, I played organ that we slept around the North Shore. Because these are the days when before the keyboards came out. I think Farfisa was just coming out with its first synthesizer, but for the most part, we slept around those Hammond B3s or variations thereof.
Do you still play any of that music, or are you strictly religious?
I mean, play
music?
Popular music?
Yeah.
On occasion, for myself. Mm-hmm. I think of myself as a consummate musician. Mm-hmm. And I used to say when I was younger, if it's written, I'll play it. If it's not written, I may have to listen to it a few times, but I'll play it. Because not unlike Gail, I started off playing in church at 5 years old. I gave my first piano recital in the basement of the old St. Mark AME Church when it was located on Avondale and Connolly Street in Orlando. Couldn't read a note of music. After 2 years of playing for the Sunday school and so forth, and like my Aunt Maggie, who lived in Winter Haven, Florida, in a place called Florence Villa, Florida, convinced my dad to pay for me to have piano lessons. Mm-hmm. And I went and studied with Miss Melita D. Wright, who was the pianist at Shiloh Baptist Church in Orlando, still located right there on Terry Street. And so I studied with Mrs. Wright until I think I was like junior high school. And then I studied with Edna Sampson Hoggart, who was a fixture in Orlando because she made the Jones High School. Excuse me, I shouldn't say she made. She continued the tradition of excellence that her teacher, Leslie Brayboy Weaver, had set down for Jones High School Choir. Mm-hmm. And Leslie Brayboy Weaver happened to be one of my teachers also. So I had both Ms. Weaver for choir, and I had Mrs. Hoggart Thrower for both piano, choir, and she is the person who sat me down at an organ in the middle of St. Mark's service. I was 10 years old. I'll never forget it. And I had been playing when the junior choir would sing on the third Sundays of the month. I had been playing at the There's a Fountain Filled with Blood. So one day in the middle of the service, she says, "Carl, play There's a Fountain on the organ." Of course, my anxiety went through the roof. I said, oh. But at this point, she was Mrs. Sampson. I said, Miss Sampson, but my feet can't touch the pedals. I don't want you to play the pedals. Just play it on the manuals. But I haven't practiced. Carl, play there. There I was. In the context of the service, I sat down on the organ. I played There's a Fountain. She was my first organ teacher. Mm-hmm. The pipe organ became my principal instrument. Mm-hmm. Because people don't really think of composers as having an instrument, even though our instrument is whatever makes sound. We wanted to cover the whole spectrum, mm-hmm. the entire spectrum. One of the things that I think makes this particular collection stand out is its section on what we call service music. That is music designed to highlight the liturgy and basically an outgrowth of the Judaic Catholic Mass tradition.
Mm-hmm. So these are songs you would hear every single time you go to church.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Kind of continuity music almost.
Right. What the Catholics call the ordinary.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we have service music in here, and we also have something very new to a lot of denominations, which is modified Anglican chant for the Psalms. The singing of Psalms is a tradition that goes all the way back to David and probably before him. One of the things that was very interesting about this process is that the committee members learned so much from each other. Gail is talking about the Seventh-day Adventists. Dr. Jason Max Ferdinand, who was just here in Orlando with the Aeolians this past spring.
In January.
Introduced us to a wealth of music that we basically were not familiar with, mm-hmm. and worship styles. Sometimes we would be going through songs and the spirit just would get in the room and we just start having church. There's no way to describe it. We just would start having church because when God moves in that mysterious way and you got a bunch of church musicians singing his praises, it's an overwhelming experience. It really is, but it's uplifting and made the work play. It's like that old theory of education. Mm-hmm. Children learn best when they're at play.
It's true.
So same thing happens with the musicians. When we play, we can move mountains. We can change hearts.
And that was Carl Maltsby and Gail Jones Murphy talking about the African-American ecumenical hymnal, One Lord, One Faith, One Baptism. And here's a track by Gail Jones Murphy called His Mercies Are New Every Day. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. You can find us on the NPR One app, download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcast. And we're online at wmfe.org/intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.
His mercies are new every day. His mercies are new every day. His mercies are new.